This is Brand to Brand Happy Hour, where marketing meets good company, great ideas, and even better drinks. All right, let's kick things off.
Welcome, everybody. Today on the show, we got a great guest. My friend Ted is joining us. Ted is an expert in what we would consider to be pre-sell branding. He's got a book called Branding for Buyout. He's got an agency. He's got 20 plus years under his belt. And I think the conventional wisdom that he's learned working at lots of other firms is there's a real missed opportunity when you let a banker tell your story. Do you want to elaborate?
I'd be happy to. And thanks for having me on, Tom. I'm a big fan of the show and the podcast. Yeah, the story really began with the fact that, you know, as a career marketer, you know, almost 30 years now.
And at some great agencies, Arnold, I mean, just you've been around the scene.
Really lucky. And like you, though, those were early days experiences from like right out of college for like the first 8-9 years. And I started my own business in my late 20s. Along the way, in the early 2000s, I just was doing my job as a marketer to help grow a business. And then a pattern happened where the clients I had were acquired, and then I'd have no more clients. And I was like, this is a horrible business model. But, you know, I had a real epiphany moment where I realized, wow, does anyone specialize in the marketing world to help not just sell more product, service, or tech to a customer, but to sell the business, the asset, to a potential acquirer? And that began the 20-year journey to develop Branding for Buyout.
But you've really stumbled upon a really interesting spot in the marketplace. I guess for me, I'd be curious, like, what do you think is the biggest challenge for why the M&A process really undervalues brands?
Okay, this is a big one to unpack. I'm glad I'm talking to a fellow brand expert. I would say there's a handful of really key defining problems with the sell side process today. First of all, most business owners have never been through an exit. They might have been building this business 10, 20, 30, 100 years, but they've never sold a business. So you know how the old saying goes, you should not walk through a minefield blindly, you should follow the person who made it through successfully. So they're at a disadvantage to begin with that they've never been through a very, very complicated process. The second thing is most businesses are not ready for exit. There's a process that you have to go through to pass due diligence. And people who are acquiring businesses are usually quite sophisticated and know what they're doing. That's another challenge that you have to overcome. And then where the real crux of the opportunity is for us and what we do is that bankers, the quarterbacks often for an exit, are the ones responsible for, quote unquote, marketing your asset, marketing your business. So let's just start with that. And I have lots of investment banker friends, and this is not a slight to them, but I always tell business owners, do you really want a banker to tell the story of your life's work? They can tell a phenomenal financial story. They can tell you what to expect for comps in the market, but their marketing is a one-page document in a SIM, a confidential investment memorandum, AKA a 50 to 100-page PowerPoint deck. And I can tell you, they're not awesome. There's no video content. They're not geofencing buyers and serving content before the exit. You know, there's just so many sophisticated ways that you can enhance perceived value that aren't being taken advantage of.
What are some of the common things that lead businesses to exit? Why do you think then they don't have their ducks in a row?
Yeah. One is that there's so much money locked up in private equity, they haven't moved any of their assets, any of their portcos. There's billions and billions and trillions of dollars waiting to move those businesses, and their LPs, their limited partners, are saying, you better sell some assets because we want a return on our investment or you don't get any more money. The second, of course, is AI. That's a pro and a con. We've seen a lot of our business owners accelerate their exit timelines because of, I'll say, fear of an AI competitor disrupting their business and decreasing their odds of a successful exit, and let alone an extraordinary exit. And the third trend I'll just highlight is what they call the silver tsunami. Baby boomers are aging out, 25% of which own their own businesses that they want to sell.
Well, you're tired and you're ready to make it make that transition happen? And maybe what you were thinking, and often I've worked with a lot of family businesses, sometimes that succession plan seems like it's there and then it evaporates. The next of kin isn't necessarily so interested in following mom or dad.
You nailed it.
And AI is such a disruption and such a force. You and I had a conversation about this the other day around just like simply having an AI roadmap is one strategy. And if you don't have an AI roadmap, you need to be able to show that you've actually rolled out AI, not just, oh, someone's using ChatGPT on their computer, but functionally within the business unit. Curious if you'd care to elaborate on that at all.
Yeah, and I know you're a wizard in B2B tech as well from a brand perspective, Tom. It's not enough if I'm going to use B2B tech where technology is pivotal for your value creation and your perceived value. It's not enough to, I think, just be using off-the-shelf efficiency tools and using AI that way. You have to literally demonstrate how your business is going to change because of AI. So we built partners around the world over the last few years, real sophisticated AI minds that can help shape a future forward vision map for a company. So even if they're not, even if they're lightly AI enabled, not AI enabled at all, or, you know, partial way, and everything keeps changing, you can actually create material value enhancement if you show a potential acquirer an AI roadmap that holds legitimate value, especially a competent one.
It seems like this is a path that they have not necessarily gone through. So I'd be curious, like, what does branding for buyout actually look like in practice? I have a vision for how I see your day-to-day and what that looks like. But for the listeners, walk us through that.
Yeah, I would walk it through in three phases. First, like any good strategy project is, you know, kind of an assessment and a positioning exercise. We break that into three pieces. We run a saleability test. Are you saleable? If you score high, there's a short timeline to an exit. If you score low, you have a long time to get ready. A typical preparation is a couple years just for the audience's benefit. That's, you know, that's a step in the process. A research insight and strategy effort to understand your category, your competition, the inside view as you look at yourself from, you know, your own four walls. And of course, the competition, finding a sweet spot strategy that allows you to keep selling to your customers, but finds the sweet spot from a really heavy duty M&A landscape analysis, both domestic, international, strategic and financial, allows us to almost turn on the radar that was off for a business owner. Because they have no idea. How long will it take? What do I need to do? How should I position myself? So imagine the radar screen being off and then all of a sudden it blinks on with an end zone in mind, with a list of things you need to do, and what we believe is the key positioning to differentiate you in the market. That's phase one. Phase two is literally the transformation process, the execution. Okay, we know generally the landscape of buyers. We know generally how we should specifically how we think we should position you. We know the operational things you need to do to get ready. Now we actually have to execute that. That can take between 6 and 18 months depending on, you know, how ready or not ready the company is. And the third is the actual sell side process where we intersect with bankers and love really good investment bankers because they are the experts. I mean, they've done this for 100 years. We're an augmentation to what they do. And sometimes it requires some effort and some learning. But when they see that we've already, I'm going to say, shaped the diamond on their behalf and done a lot of the work that is very difficult for them to do, like extracting information out of the company when the company's busy, that they're like, oh my gosh, they've positioned it, they've shaped the diamond, it's going to pass due diligence. I can now sell faster and at a higher price tag. Why wouldn't I want to do that?
As a marketer, I can tell you firsthand with my experience working with brands, sometimes the tip of the iceberg is the, I need this. We need to update this. We need to retool our position. We want to update our website. We want to work on this. And then you get five or six questions in and you're like, okay, and let's just personify this person. Let's give the person's name Joe. Joe's giving you all this information and you find out, okay, Joe's further aspirations are that he actually wants to partner with private equity or do something to make a change in the business. So I guess if we're fast forwarding, when Joe makes his way to you, has he already stumbled and worked with an investment banker and got a valuation that he wasn't happy with? What does that look like?
What a great question. I'm going to use an example, a real one, of a past exit, a company called Embotics. It's a cloud management platform, exited, I think it was in late 2019. Had met with their CEO and C-suite and founder, and they were private equity owned. And one of the things the CEO came to me about was, we think we should change the name. The company's tried to sell twice unsuccessfully. And I'm like, I doubt it's the name. But I understand why you're asking the question. Let us do a little diligence. And my instinct right out of the gate with a company that wanted to exit, a name change can be very expensive. I mean, you're talking about capital expenses, names on a sign out in front of the building, you know, every single touch point, and a name change means a rebrand. And I'm like, I don't think you want to do that after our assessment. And I said, also, you've tried to sell twice unsuccessfully in the U.S. Our thesis for this brand is that it's going to be an international buyer. In some cases, when the U.S. is leading a particular technology race, not always the case, but in this case it was true, often an international buyer wants to leapfrog where they are in advance, get ahead of their competition. So it ended up long tail that a company called Snow, a Swedish company called Snow, bought Embotics for a very, very high multiple after they had let's just say they put the house on the market twice and failed, and then it gets the black X. It gets the scarlet letter.
Right? Nobody wants to go see that house. There's something wrong with it.
Exactly.
It probably has a foundation problem or Who knows?
And it was a great company. They just didn't have a clear story. And you know, in B2B tech, if someone creates a disruptive technology, within 3 years, there's another 10 lookalikes. Even if you're the best, you're now part of a Me Too pack. That is bullseye for what happened for them. They had fallen into a Me Too status, a homogenous status, and we needed to, as we say, help them skate to where the puck was going to be, not to where it was. And that's key in positioning for, you know, reaching the highest possible valuation.
You and I talked before about, I think it was Popcorners, you preparing, you know, you almost fantasizing about what the buyer could be and then designing a playbook for what that looks like so that it's like by the time you get to the aspirational acquirer, you've got all your ducks in a row. Tell me more about that.
That was an incredible journey that started, I think, around 2016 with Paul Nardone, the CEO, and his marketing consultant, Meredith McFerrin, who now runs Drive by DraftKings. So very, very seasoned operators who, you know, I just can't say enough great things about it. At one point, we knew that one of the potential acquirers was Pepsi. And just for the instance of storytelling, and I had seen Paul the other day and we joked about this. One of the things we did was create kind of a future forward video to show, of course, the great things are happening with Popcorners at the time and alluding to product expansion with two products. They had Flex and Flourish, and basically painting the future of Popcorners in video format. And one of the things we did just for fun is because Popcorners was sold on JetBlue, we photoshopped a JetBlue plane like Popcorners had branded the entire plane. And Paul's like, yeah, we haven't done that yet. And I'm like, I don't think Pepsi Corp Dev is going to care if you've actually realize that vision, what you're doing is showing Pepsi that you're thinking big and that this brand is worthy of, you know, joining the Pepsi family.
I think people underestimate the power of storytelling of not just where you are, but where you want to be and where you will be in a few years. It's a missed opportunity. And I love the fact that people come in with the constraints. Well, we've never done that. That's okay. Show us what you could do. Show us what your vision is. A lot of these acquirers, it's, you know, some the senior team is sticking around. It's not like you buy the brand and then everybody goes away. So they want to know where you're going to be. You said, obviously, like skating to where the puck's going to be. They want to know where you're going to be. They want to know that you're not just being a part of their portfolio and it's just going to be static. I'm curious if you have any thoughts to, like, you know, what brands need to be doing to just keep themselves current, even long before they're ready to come out of the shoot and have conversations with people like you and me.
I'll give a shout out to one of my favorite people on earth, Mike Welts, the CMO of Wasabi, technology brand, cloud storage brand here in Boston. And I'll give you an origin story that Mike and I worked on since 2017, but he was the leader of this. Originally, Wasabi was going to be called Blue Archive. Blue Archive, the name was limiting to archive storage, which is a limited opportunity in market. Cloud storage was where the world was going. And cloud storage was already a category that Gartner and the analysts had already defined. And Wasabi at the time was a pre-revenue startup. But David Friend and Jeff Flowers, the guy who started Carbonite, another data storage company, were coming to town and they were going to build this brand, Blue Archive. And Mike said, well, first of all, that isn't going to cut it because that's a limiting market. It's also not necessarily going to be translated internationally. It's not overly pithy. It doesn't like drive excitement. What if, because their technology was new and wasn't cold storage, which means it's hard to retrieve your data. This is hot storage, which means you can actively retrieve your data on the fly. What if we steal the equity from cloud storage, but put an adjective in front of it and call it hot cloud storage? So we're borrowing the equity or amplifying an existing category. And what if we name the company Wasabi? Hot condiment, hot cloud storage, translates internationally. They immediately created a differentiator in a Me Too category.
Well, I think one other thing I'd love to dig into, like, you've had 20 plus exits. What are common mistakes that CEOs make and leaders make?
I'll give you a couple nuggets that have come top to mind. First, you need to be educated. We partnered a lot with Babson College. Love that school. And Candy Brush, a longtime friend who was provost or vice provost of the entrepreneurship program, said, you know, Ted, what you're onto is really interesting because all of the education, at least in the US, is how to start and scale a business. Virtually none is on how to exit. So when you think about it, I think buying and selling a house has been pretty stressful for me. Buying and selling a business is 1,000x because 90% of your net worth is likely tied up in that business. It's a really complicated process that involves lawyers and wealth managers and investment bankers and all the players that you could think of, and of course, brand, now that we do what we do. But you need to get educated. You need to have a game plan. You need to build a team. You need to have the psychology that, you know, it's a process and you have to respect the expert advice you get. It can also be expensive and scary and emotionally exhausting because you're running your business as you're trying to exit it.
Running a business is lonely. It's lonely at the top.
It is for me.
It is just such an emotional time, no matter what you do. Coming back to what we were talking about before, I guess I'm curious how you think AI and data are going to change the way that we see exits happen over the next 5 years, 10 years, even the next 2 years.
It's already happened. I met a young group, a combination of a young investment banker meeting an AI mind giant just last week that is already thinking about how to build AI agents to shore up some of the diligence needs across different operational departments. Met another group that has essentially created an AI for corp dev, sourcing potential buyers, matchmaking. I think it's going to fundamentally disrupt the sell side process as we know it today. It's going to change roles. It's going to change speed. It's going to change a lot. Blessedly, I think that the thing that AI isn't going to solve for right away is the complexity of a differentiated positioning in the market. Kind of the creativity of deal making is hard to replicate, but it is going to create massive efficiency and all kinds of innovation in the space.
A lot of organizations have tried to pilot AI. A lot of organizations have made significant investments in AI, and a lot of organizations have crashed, burned, and failed. And a lot of people are like, they're not, I wouldn't say they're necessarily pulling back, but there's a little bit of apathy. Plus, you have your teams, and your teams are not necessarily juiced up or excited about the prospect of AI. We're in a creative space. I know a lot of creators, they're like, oh, I have issues with it, or they're maybe hesitant. You have your early adopters that are in love with it. You have a lot of CEOs that are like, this is great. This could be really helpful. But they're still living in like generative AI, having a conversation, a small context window. They're not necessarily really leveraging it. And I think the message for listeners is it's like, if you're really early in an implementation, I'll use air quotes, implementation, maybe you're still just literally using generative AI tools. You're going to ChatGPT and having a conversation. Like what shockwave would you want to send to the listeners of like, you know, the time is now to start really thinking about how to utilize and leverage these tools?
Yeah, the time was actually a few years ago is the first thing I'd say. And having lived through the .com era and the .bomb, anytime seismic shifts happen with technology, obviously there's a meteoric rise, there's usually a fall, and then there's a normalcy. We don't really think about using the internet anymore, or dial up.
Yeah.
The same thing will happen with AI. I took a MIT online course for, you know, strategic implementation of AI. I believe the stat was 300 million jobs will go away and 400 million new ones will evolve. So whatever that looks like, you know, I have always been a real strong proponent of getting ahead of technology, embracing it, because the fear slows you down. So I would just encourage everyone to get as fluent as they can on AI usage, AI enablement, how to apply AI to their businesses. And statistically, it's fact. Companies are going to be measured on probably smaller headcount in the future. Fewer people doing more because of AI. That doesn't mean you wipe out your team. It means you reallocate and think about how they're using the technology so they can do more better, and they can innovate more. And we have the same debate in our own company. You know, different people have different risk tolerance, but we've mandated it. We made our head of strategy, Leif Holtzman, the head of strategy in AI a couple years ago. And we're already helping our clients with, you know, baseline implementation and those AI enablement roadmaps that we talked about to enhance value.
A lot of organizations have baptized somebody in the organization as the AI czar, or who knows. And it's just kind of, I'll use the IT example, but it's like when you're a small company, you're really small. It's like, well, that's the gal that knows the most about it. They'll be the IT person. AI is so fundamentally different. You can't just baptize or anoint somebody or make them the AI person if there isn't some AI enthusiast, lover, early adopter on the other side. So kudos to you, and kudos to the brands that I work with that have been successful. But a lot of brands are still sort of, they're trying to figure it out. And I think it's really, really an important message to say, hey, this is coming. It's already here. Whether we like it or not, we really need to figure out how to take advantage of it. Talking about PI and investment banks again, just like, you know, you said, you don't necessarily want necessarily a banker to be responsible for telling your story. Do you think that they're, you know, likely to start innovating and catching on to a movement of putting more emphasis and effort towards it? We talk about, you know, this beautiful multi-page sim, 50 to 100 page PowerPoint. As marketers, we're whipping up 50 to 100 page PowerPoints all the time. That's not what these PowerPoints look like. They're text dense. Do you think that they're going to follow the wave? What do you think is going to happen in this marketplace?
Well, back to my enormous respect for investment bankers, The good ones really know what they're doing, and they're going to increase your probability of success and obviously get you the most value you can extract. I do think, having knocked on the door for 20 years, that there is a far greater acceptance to innovation in the space now, not just because of AI, because deal flow has been stalled for 3 years. When things get tough, people start to innovate. And I believe people open up their aperture for innovation and value creation. And this falls squarely into that, again, augmentation to the process, a reimagining of the process, but the bones of the process work. So, investment bankers don't need us to do what they do. I think business owners are the ones disadvantages, and quite frankly, investment banks, without bringing the full firepower to the table to unlock the most value you can.
Everybody wants a higher multiple. Everybody wants a larger valuation. And when times are good and capital is readily available, rates are nice, I think there's probably a little bit less pressure in the marketplace. We were talking the other day about, you were like, we're seeing more demand than ever. And in some ways it's because, hey, maybe poor Joe is not getting the valuation Joe would have gotten 2-3 years ago, 6 months ago, because of all of these sort of seismic shifts. And that makes people have to get creative.
Raging agreement. I'll give you one other, Tom. The biggest CEOs in the world of the biggest companies, I'll say BlackRock CEO, you'll find a commonality at the very top. They say the story of our brands, the story of our portcos is one of the most valuable things we can bring to bear. So I think there's an acknowledgement and an understanding. It's just sometimes people are slow to adopt. Sometimes people are just, hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, let's look at Blockbuster. Let's look at the taxi cab to Uber to Netflix. Seismic change is coming, and you either adapt or die. So that's how I look at it.
And adapt or die. If we could do it all over again, if poor Joe could start at the very beginning with extra time, he's not ready to sell. He's just thinking about it. It's a natural progression. It could happen down the line. What would the advice be to those CEOs? And in my camp, working with clients now for like 15 years, in so many ways, it's about asking the right questions and getting to their deeper aspirations. Yeah. The pie in the sky vision. What do you want to be? Where would you want to go? So you can make fundamental, small, step-by-step improvements to the business, improvements to the brand, etc., before you feel like there's a clock going in the background and you have a short window to make big seismic shifts for your brand. So rewinding the tape, what would your advice be to those CEOs and marketing leaders?
First and foremost, an exit-ready brand, whether you sell it or not, is a superior business. So getting ready for an exit, even if you don't exit, means you're operating a totally superior business. So we often run into that, like, timing is everything. Sometimes you want to move faster, sometimes you want to move slower. We've had clients retrench for years because timing just wasn't right. So you do have to think about timing. I would give the advice of just encouraging you to learn what exit ready means and aspiring to that, because it's going to mean you're going to be a more valuable business, a more successful business, whether you sell or not. The other thing, piece of advice, other than educating, get educated on the process, is start innovating and being the entrepreneur you are now. And start thinking about what the future is, because another wise person once told me, there's the deal you do and then the deal you live. I have guys in my CEO group who have exited and have PTSD. They don't know what to do with themselves. They made a boatload of money and they've worked their whole lives. They're like, what do I do now? It's literally PTSD. There's other people who are beholden to an earnout of some kind and are not happy once they've sold their business, with another 2 or 3 years of sticking in the quarry to get where they want to go. And then there's some people who couldn't be happier skipping into the fields with the outcome. You really have to think about the pre, during, post process and think about those three phases and what they mean to you and to your life, because this is intricately woven into the fabric of your life.
a lot of these CEOs are happily married, so they haven't dated in a while, right? So this whole process is a series of dates. You start a conversation. Some deals never even make it to due diligence. It's a hamster wheel. There's a lot that's involved. And so I think, yeah, it's really important. You got to look yourself in the mirror and understand what your fundamental goals are and do it while you still have gas in the tank. It's super hard. There's a billion books about growth in business. Everything. Grow or die. And for those that are on that hamster wheel, sometimes we stop looking over our shoulder. We stop thinking about what our position in the marketplace is. We get out of the habit of some of those really, really important pieces. I love that you talked about, and I'm in a number of peer groups as well, the other side of it, right? For some people, it's like they've been chasing that dream. They realize that dream. And it's actually a nightmare. So there's a lot of different components to it, but I do feel like the single sentence really is that by living this philosophy, you are running a better business. I've worked with a lot of clients that, like, maybe it's moving to and transitioning to a franchise model and wanting to kind of bring that to market or starting to think about exit. No matter what, it improves the value of your business. If you have your ducks in a row, you have your SOPs, whatever that looks like, and the business is mature to that point, then it's more turnkey. It's less about your day-to-day or your leadership team's day-to-day roles that keep the business running and plug the holes in the boat. You have a successful business that's sort of moving downstream. And so I think that that's really, really a critical, critical piece. I love the role that you play with the organizations that you're in. I love that it's, you know, you talked about it before. It's not a transactional thing. You're with it, and in some cases, for the long haul. I'd love to know any other pieces that you feel like are important to highlight about what that journey is.
Yeah, I'll lean in again on the what you would call it is the post-exit integration strategy or post-acquisition integration strategy. A lot of energy goes into how we're going to exit. It's really important to explain to the potential acquirer and yourself what the post looks like and how to either navigate that as a company acquiring you and you continuing to work there, or you leaving, or what have you. I would double click on the thinking that comes after the event is one thing. I would also probably give the advice to keep pushing yourself to embrace technology and the change, volatile change we're going through now. You have to put your feet in there. You can't put a toe in.
Let's talk about the book. You buy the book. It's got everything you need. No, I'm just kidding. But talk us through, like, what is a good time to sort of pull that book open and start that conversation?
Anytime. The very end of the book says, begin with the end in mind. And I know one of your questions later in the comment here is business cliches. I think I'm going to pull that forward for a second. Maybe I can recycle it. But I believe the biggest cliche is that the American dream is to start and own a business.
Mm.
I believe the American dream is to start, own, and exit a business so you can enjoy your life's work and the fruits of your labor.
Wow.
And I think most people just don't know how to exit. And if you're not educated and you're flying blind and you don't know what to expect, just realize that can be a pretty rocky road and decrease your chances for an exit and decrease the value that you might get out of it. So you got to treat it really seriously. This isn't some cursory activity. This is, you know, this is the final game or one of the games you're going to play. And it is chess, not checkers, as they say.
There's no fear mongering on this show.
No, not even. And like we talk about fatigue, there's tons of business owners that are fired up. This isn't their only game.
No.
They call it, you know, your first bite at the apple. And then they get the firepower they need by private equity or strategic investor who then gives them 10 times the firepower to go keep realizing their vision and they keep going.
Yeah, this process can add fuel to the tank.
100%.
And I mean, it can get the Joes listening, right? Refired up about the business, recommitted to the business, because in so many ways, they have another thought partner to bring to the conversation. I think that's so important. I love that you said from a cliche you'd like to retire, that it's really that American dream or philosophy, that the dream is to get in the business. And a lot of people get into the business and don't realize how much the hamster wheel that the business is. And then they're like, oh, I gotta get out. So it's just really about like leaving this conversation with the concept of you have a lot of tools at your disposal, and it's never too early to start that process. It's never too early to start thinking about it. What's one branding principle that you swear by?
Never think that your opinion should come first. And let me unpack that. You need to think like a buyer, not like a seller. You need to think like a customer, not the person selling the product, service, or tech. So meaning your natural default as a human is my opinion's what matters, what I think is going to move the needle. If you don't think like your target audience, you've already failed the test before you even began.
You got to leave the boardroom. You can't just have the beautiful, bright minds of your senior team or your marketing, branding folks, your advisors, that inner circle again. And I think that I'd even add to that point that your audience shifts. So even if you did a focus group 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, you can't necessarily just pull that out and utilize that, because market shifts happen. Expectations change.
And sentiment changes in real time. I'm just thinking about this Cracker Barrel brand. They changed their logo and get rid of like the core fundamental heritage of the brand for a different logo. Look what happens. If you have a fierce following and really passionate fans of your brand, and you radically change it and surprise them and they don't like it, your stock price and your market cap and your sales can plummet if you're not smart about what you're doing.
What people do, how they handle that backlash, though, says so much more about the marketing team, the brand, than anything else. And I think even just thinking about the Cracker Barrel example, interesting to see them walk that tightrope walk.
I call that anticipatory marketing, and we've done that quite a bit for certain clients. It's not enough just to give them an idea. You have to think about, in anticipation, a reaction. And, you know, I think about, this is a while ago, but at one point, I don't know if I even have the story right, but close enough, KFC ran out of chicken at one of their locations. What? I mean, like, you're a fried chicken brand. You don't run out of chicken. The PR move that they did was so genius, they changed KFC to FCK, as in the expletive, shorthand expletive, and apologized. You know, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, all over the place. It was such a clever response that it swung the boomerang back and boosted the equity. Countless examples of really smart marketing about, don't just think about putting something into the wild. Think about the earthquake and then the aftershocks that come with it and how to milk those for all they're worth.
100%. And this is why it's so important that you have a really strong internal team. You have a strong external partner. Everybody has a different point of view about how they view the world. And when you have that meeting of minds and people can come together, that's where you can make kind of transformative impact.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, that's why you talk to guys like you, Tom.
100%. Well, this was such a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. If people are interested in finding the book, it's on Amazon.
It is.
It's anywhere you would be likely to find Branding for Buyout. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Tom, I'm super grateful. Thanks to you and your team. This has been awesome.
Awesome. All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
And look forward to seeing you again soon, my friend.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
And that's a wrap on today's Happy Hour. Keep the drinks cold and the branding bold.